WikiLeaks outs companies doing business with Syria.
And the world's central banks launch a new round of economic stimulus. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. It's the Marketplace Midday Update for Thursday, July 5th. Along with the WikiLeaks stuff, we're going to look at a new report out in Japan looking at the nuclear crisis and looking at the Japanese and saying something to the effect of, the fault is not in giant earthquakes, my friends, but in ourselves.
Also, a lot of jobs news coming out in the next couple of days, and that'll, of course, culminate tomorrow with the big June employment report from the Labor Department. But this morning, we got some clues about the jobs picture, and we're going to tell you about all that and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Well, this morning, WikiLeaks announced what it calls the Syria files. Over the next 2 months, the organization is going to release more than 2 million emails to and from the Syrian government and Syrian companies. On the other end of those conversations, Western companies that might not be so crazy about their business being outed. Here's WikiLeaks' Sarah Harrison. This is from the press conference this morning.
The Syria files shine a light on the inner workings of the Syrian government and economy, but they also reveal how the West and Western companies say one thing and do another.
Those emails will come out in a trickle. Checking the site this morning, though, today's uncomfortable debut appears to include a thread of Syrian emails with the Italian defense contractor Finmeccanica, which is partly owned by the Italian government, and the subject line on some of those emails, chopper accessories. So we get some sense of what's to come. WikiLeaks, per its usual protocol, is not saying anything about where it got all these emails.
Well, it's been exactly a week, Jeff, since the Supreme Court announced that President Obama's health care overhaul is constitutional, which brings us now to Attitude Check, our weekly partnership with the polling firm Gallup.
And the latest poll numbers suggest
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is editor-in-chief at Gallup, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Well, last time we talked, Frank, it was right before the Supreme Court ruling came out, and you told me that the law as a whole was unpopular. Has that changed in the polling since the decision?
There have been a number of polls that have been conducted since the decision last Thursday by the Supreme Court, and all of them show not a lot of change, that Americans are still very divided. They were divided on the decision by the Supreme Court, and they were divided on the law itself. So I'm not sure, so far at any rate, maybe it'll be a long-term change, that the decision by the Supreme Court actually changed anybody's attitudes about the Affordable Care Act.
How do Americans think that the health care law, now that it looks like it's going to go into effect in full, how do they think it will affect the economy?
I don't think anybody knows, even your most brilliant Nobel Prize-winning economist, how it's really going to affect the economy when it's phased in over the next several years. And certainly the average American doesn't have a precise knowledge. But perception is reality. That's what we measure here at Gallup. So we just finished asking this week, all in all, will it be helpful or hurtful for the economy? And we find a tilt to Americans saying the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, will hurt the economy by 46% to 37% margin. So these perceptions are... And again, this is important because the economy is the top problem, Americans tell us. That's a negative for those who favor the ACA, because Americans say, based on their guess, it's going to hurt the economy more than help it.
And do we know why they think that?
We don't know for sure why, and I'm not sure, as I say, anybody knows. You know, hospital stocks went up. It may help that portion of the economy. It may hurt small business. Nobody really knows, I think, long term. I think a lot of these are just knee-jerk reactions to liking or not liking the plan. But the fact that Americans do tie it into the economy is important, because that could drive their perceptions of the act overall and, of course, how they might vote for, let's say, for example, Obama versus Romney.
And I want to ask you about that, Frank, because obviously Mitt Romney's health care overhaul in Massachusetts has been called the model for President Obama's health care overhaul federally. And I wonder, do people make a distinction in terms of who they would like to handle health care going forward between Romney and Obama?
Yeah, Obama has the edge there. In fact, there has been some polling that was conducted since last Thursday's decision where you said, you know, do you trust Obama on health care? Do you trust Romney on health care? And Obama clearly has the edge over Romney, as he has in the past. So all in all, it is a perceptual edge for the president rather than Romney on health care.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at Gallup, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Well, as Jeremy and I speak to you this moment, markets in Europe and in the U.S. Seem to be trending down. But overseas, at least, all signs point to stimulus. The Bank of England, European Central Bank, China's Central Bank, all stepping on the gas this morning, lowering interest rates. In the case of Britain, starting a new round of quantitative easing.
But meanwhile, there is some improvement in the U.S. job market to report. First-time claims for state unemployment benefits were down last week by 14,000 to 374,000. And this morning we learned that the number of planned job cuts at U.S. companies dropped last month to the lowest level in 13 months. That's according to the job placement firm Challenger, Gray & Christmas. And we've got CEO John Challenger with us now to discuss. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, John, that seems like good news with planned layoffs dropping to a 13-month low, is it?
I think it is good news. We've seen now, for the third consecutive year, a slowdown in the economy with more job cuts over the spring and early summer. But each time it's bounced back, let's hope that this is a sign that employers are now moving towards holding on to their employees more rather than letting them go.
Well, let me know one thing here. I looked down into your report, and it says that the number of planned job cuts for the first half of this year, which is around 300,000 or so, is still far fewer than the number we saw back in the years before the recession. And it seems like with a struggling economy, you'd have more layoffs, wouldn't you?
Well, we're not seeing the kind of mergers and acquisitions that were leading to major cuts that we saw then. And we've moved into a period where the economy is kind of this slow growth mode. Employers are just sitting on their employees, standing pat, and we're not seeing that kind of much greater change in dynamism perhaps we saw in the economy then.
Well, what do you expect the Labor Department will tell us about job growth for last month tomorrow?
We don't see anything major happening in terms of job creation, which would be the key to driving unemployment down. It seems likely we'll stay at this low 8%, around 8%, it's 8.2% right now, level of unemployment.
John Challenger, CEO of Challenger, Gray & Christmas, thanks as always.
Thank you.
In London, as we said a moment ago, the Bank of England is pumping another $78 billion into the economy to spur lending as Europe tries to work its way through the financial crisis. This is probably not the time you would expect Europe's tallest skyscraper to be opening up. But that is exactly what's happening today in London with a building called the Shard. The challenge will be filling the Shard up. Here's the BBC's John Bithrie.
The Shard has completely changed London's traditionally low-rise skyline. This elongated glass pyramid contains a hotel, apartments and office space, as well as the best views in Britain. But many Londoners see it as a symbol of the greed and excess in the years before the financial crisis. And others simply think it's out of place, like Simon Jenkins, a well-known journalist and author.
It's a beautiful building. It would look wonderful in Dubai. I think it has very little to do with the architecture or the language of London. It's a statement, it's a gesture, it's a sort of virility symbol. It really has no place, I think, in the language of London development and planning over the centuries.
The Shard nearly didn't get built. When the crash came, the project went off the rails. It was saved by a group of investors from Qatar. But when they'll get their $200 million investment back isn't clear. Demand for office space in central London is weak, so much of this iconic building is likely to stay empty for some time to come. In London, I'm the BBC's John Bithrie for Marketplace.
So all through the recession, we've been hearing about how luxury brands in many cases are not slowing down. And according to Reuters, more and more luxury brands are trying to expand their stores to the moon, or at least to the airport terminal. In recent years, sales at airports and other travel venues have risen far more quickly than at regular stores for many chains.
Here to talk with us for today's Midday Extra is Pam Danziger, president of Unity Marketing, which focuses on the luxury market. Hi, Pam.
Hello, how are you doing?
Doing well. Well, thanks for being here. And let me ask you first, why do you think retailers are opening new stores in the airports in a big way?
Well, I mean, it's basically that you're going to go fishing where the fish are. And if you look at airports and the kind of people that travel, particularly in international markets, it's mostly people who have, you know, a little extra cash, are more affluent than the regular folks. So that's essentially why the airports have gotten to become a focus for many of these brands.
Well, let's just be honest, right? Airport stores are kind of a ripoff, right? Are they taking advantage They're very expensive. You buy a juice at the airport and it's $8. What are they taking advantage of there that luxury brands maybe are trying to get in on?
Well, and I'm not recommending this necessarily as a growth strategy for luxury brands, okay. But I mean the fact is we've had duty free stores for years where people are exposed to more premium brands, although in a theoretically more of a discount environment. But it seems like more and more retailers are looking at airports as viable retail opportunities. I mean, essentially you are a sort of a captive audience, and many times you have some time to kill. The people who travel have got extra money. Yeah. So it makes sense in that case. But, again, when I'm traveling, it's like I don't want to be carting bags on the plane and so on. So I think there's some real issues about going that route as a key growth strategy.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty turbulent, if you will, business, the airline business. The ticket prices go up, they go down. The fuel prices go up and down. So does that make it a risky thing for a retailer to do to get in on the airport business?
Well, again, I don't know necessarily it's risky, except in the fact that I think there's a danger of overexposure, and particularly with luxury brands. I mean, there's something about the special status of the exclusivity of these brands being behind the glass and sort of being inaccessible. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the luxe that people want to buy into. So by putting them sort of out in the crosshairs in terms of where everybody's walking and showing these brands, I think it can in fact threaten the integrity of the brands.
And let's just be specific about some of the brands that we might be talking about here. I mean, who do you think might be taking a bit of a risk to be opening up more in that environment?
Well, I mean, the brand that I think is the most vulnerable in terms of overexposure is Louis Vuitton. I mean, they have really built a huge business, not to mention all the fakes and the phonies that are out there. I think that they are very, very vulnerable. And I don't know when the tipping point's coming, but I think it's close, where they're going to tip and they're going to lose that luxury status that they had and become overexposed.
One element of this that I noted just reading up quickly is that this may not be aimed at Americans. We're thinking of this as Americans, of course, because we are. But this kind of shopping may not be something we do, even if others do.
Exactly. Well, I mean, a lot of New York and L.A. travel or shopping is really being boosted by visitors because we really do have the cheapest prices in the world. And, a lot of affluence from China and Japan and, Europe and everywhere else are coming and making shopping part of that whole focus of their travel experience in the United States.
Well, Pam Danziger, president of Unity Marketing, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
South Korea wants to resume whaling in its own domestic waters. The country made the proposal at a gathering of the International Whaling Commission, which is meeting right now in Panama. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
There's been an international ban on commercial whaling since 1986, but Japan has skirted the moratorium by continuing what it calls scientific whaling, allegedly to monitor whale populations and their impact on the fishing industry. Now, South Korea is angling to do the same. South Korean officials want to be allowed to conduct scientific whaling in the country's coastal waters. They say a resumption of whaling is needed to determine if endangered minke whales are depleting commercial fish stocks. England's Environment Minister Richard Bennion condemned the move.
I think that it's commercial whaling by any other name. Japan already carries out allegedly scientific whaling, which we all know involves the death of a great many whales. We don't want to see other countries start this. We want the moratorium to stay in place and for countries not to try and find ways around it by dressing it up as scientific.
Whale meat is considered a delicacy in South Korea, and a limited amount is available in markets there from whales that wash ashore or are accidentally caught in fishnets. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Once they get back from the holiday recess, congressional Republicans have their sights trained on Dodd-Frank. The financial reform law is supposed to correct problems that fed the 2008 financial meltdown. But the House GOP says it's not just the big Wall Street banks that are feeling the pinch from the law. It's small community banks, too. Here's more from Marketplace's Shireen Marisol Meraji.
David Schweikert is on the House Financial Services Committee. The Arizona Republican says Dodd-Frank's new rules are scaring community bankers in his district.
They're hedging. They're holding back capital.
Frank Sorrentino, chairman and CEO of North Jersey Community Bank, says that's true.
Of course we want to lend, but the issue is, you know, we may have our hands somewhat tied for fear of where these regulations are going.
He's worried rules meant to rein in big banks could hurt small banks like his.
Like any members of an industry that's about to endure new regulations, they're skeptical and nervous, and that's very understandable.
Robert Jackson helped the Obama administration draft some of the provisions that eventually became Dodd-Frank. He says the act was written with small banks in mind.
And so they exempted small banks from many of the most important provisions of Dodd-Frank. But the bottom line is it's far too soon to tell.
You see, this month marks Dodd-Frank's second anniversary, and many of the regulations have yet to be enacted. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
Well, Jeff, yesterday, what did you do for the 4th of July?
I worked.
Yeah.
And then I slept through some fireworks. But I had some good food in between.
Good. Well, I slept through the fireworks once I got back to New York. But I was in Boston yesterday, and I saw the U.S. Navy's Blue Angels fly over the harbor, which was really amazing. I took a video of it, which we've put up at marketplace.org.
Cool.
And beneath the Blue Angels were hundreds of party boats, everybody celebrating all over the harbor. And then off to the side, there was the USS Constitution, which is, of course, the oldest commissioned warship afloat in the world. They call it Old Ironsides, and it was first launched back in 1797.
Wow. The original party boat.
The original party boat, indeed. And the late 1700s and the time of that USS Constitution launch is where we're going to go next to take a look at the economic independence that we've seen throughout American history with Marketplace Economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, let's go right back to the beginning of the Republic, Chris. How did we interact with the rest of the world economically back in the late 18th century?
So we're back at the George Washington administration, and it was a major debate, Jeremy. So on one hand, you had Treasury Secretary Hamilton, and he wanted to take tariffs, you know, a tax, a fee on imported goods. And he didn't want to discriminate against anybody. Keep the tariffs low, and let's trade with all kinds of nations. On the other side, you had Thomas Jefferson, Secretary of State, and his congressional ally, James Madison. And they felt that the United States, we were politically independent of Britain, but we're economically too dependent on them. So they wanted to have higher tariffs. George Washington, he ruled in favor of Hamilton. So it was an important step in this notion of we're economically interdependent with the rest of the world. We want to trade with the rest of the world, and we don't want to discriminate against particular nations.
And how did that trend continue as we got into the 19th century in American history?
Yeah, you know, it's really, you know, the United States is part of this global economy and it's kind of shifted in certain ways. But take a look at the railroad. I mean, economic history is fascinating, and it's the railroad that united the United States economically. Well, yeah, half the total bonds issued by the railroad companies owned by foreigners, a quarter of the stock. So foreign capital really built the U.S. railroad system, in other words, foreign capital, united the nation.
Well, and foreign capital is still incredibly important. The Chinese are some of our biggest bondholders. What happened with that coming into the 20th century, Chris?
Well, you mentioned, you know, foreign capital, Chinese bondholders. Well, what about human capital, knowledge, experience? So the story, the secret ingredient of U.S. growth in the latter part of the 20th century, early 21st century, is immigrants. Take a look at Silicon Valley. Half of all startups were founded by immigrants. Wander through cities, and you'll see neighborhoods that have been revived by immigrant entrepreneurs. So I think we still have an interdependent economy.
Marketplace Economics correspondent Chris Farrell, thanks as always, and happy 4th of July.
Happy 4th of July to you.
Do you like Taco Bell, Jeremy?
You know, occasionally if I'm on the road or something.
I think there's a place for it.
There's a definite place when you want to spend
$5 or $4 and just pack your stomach. I've been there. Well, apparently Taco Bell is getting all fancy on us. And starting today, the fast food chain is introducing a gourmet-style menu called Cantina Bell.
Cantina Bell.
So think $5 for a burrito instead of a buck. That's interesting, and let's learn more about it from Marketplace's Adrian Hill.
Can I get a Doritos Locos Taco Supreme, please?
Your total's going to be a Dorito, thank you.
My total, less than $2. But can a restaurant known for its cheap, high school boy-enticing eats attract a different sort of customer with Haas avocado guacamole and cilantro rice? RJ Hadavi is an analyst at Morningstar.
I think you can go after a wider audience, whether it be, you know, an older demographic or a little bit more health-conscious demographic.
But he doesn't think we're going to wind up with yoga mat-toting women fighting taco-hungry teens to get through the door at Taco Bell. Darren Tristano is with food research firm Technomic.
They may not attract the Chipotle consumer over from Chipotle burritos.
But
they very much may get their customers to move up a rung, spend a little bit more, increase their check average, and benefit the chain overall.
That is, assuming their current customers are willing to back away from their Doritos taco.
I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Well, Jeff, did you hear about the big scientific discovery yesterday, the Higgs boson?
The God particle, they call it, right?
The God particle, the subatomic particle, also known as the missing cornerstone of physics. Well, I'm not going to explain what it is because I did not do very well in high school physics.
Me either.
And I actually had to read the articles a few times just sort of to really understand what they were talking about. But it is being called a huge win for science. However, it was a loss for physicist Stephen Hawking. He told the BBC that he had made a bet a while back with a colleague that this particle would never be found. And now he owes the guy $100.
Well, and now here's a little physics news that maybe is a little easier for all of us to wrap our heads around. 15 seconds. Now, that's about how much more time we have for the podcast. But it is also how long it took the entire July 4th fireworks show planned for San Diego's Glorieta Bay to explode in a giant ball of flame all at once. So obviously something went very wrong with the Big Bay boom, but at least no one can say it didn't live up to its name, huh?
That's too bad. You know, I remember when I was living in Santa Monica years ago, and there's always fog rolling into Santa Monica, and all the rest of Southern California had their fireworks displays, but Santa Monica could not because it was too foggy. It's always disappointing when that happens.
It's always either it's fog or it's everything catching fire at once.
Exactly.
At least people can tell the story. I was there when it exploded.
That's right. Well, in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.